Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got!
Listen.
Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. And joining me today is a man who appropriately orders Michael Mann's films in their levels of quality in his top 10 list. Number 3, Insider. Number 2, Miami Vice. Number 1, Heat. He is a film critic on sabbatical. He is a Chicagoan, like the subject of this very podcast. He is got bylines at Ebert Voices, but he is the Metaplex.com. This is at Metaplex Movies, Brendan Hodges. Thank you very much for taking some time off of your sabbatical to come and join me to chat Michael Mann and Heat on One Heat Minute. I really appreciate it, mate.
I'm very happy to be here.
Awesome. All right. Well, guys, we're going to get fast. We're going to go fast straight into this show because there's lots to talk about with Brendan and such a wonderful minute. So Brendan and I are going to dive in and watch this right now. A great transition minute, couple of different sequences, some ruthless Neil McCauley as he's reeling from all the events that have been happening. So you guys take a listen and we're going to come back and talk about it.
Here. Neil is still here. I can feel it.
For how long?
7-8 hours max.
What did you do? That was you?
It's what I don't do. I don't sell metal. Would have been okay. You fly out after. Now it's jammed. So we gotta go together.
Those other people were with you?
My friend, Michael. He knew the risk. He didn't have to be there. Rains, you get wet. Get packed. Let's go.
Awesome. Brendan. There it is. Ruthless Neil McCauley. I tell you what I do. I don't sell medals. Talk to me, sir.
Okay, so I'm actually really excited that this turned out to be the minute that I got to talk about, because I feel as though when people talk about Michael Mann, they talk about the macro-mannisms.
Yes.
If you know what I mean by that. The famous Michael Mann stuff. It's often, I think we talk about the nuts and bolts of what he does to make scenes work. And this scene is full of that stuff.
Yes.
Right. And I think we're going to dive in and have a lot of fun talking about it. But this scene is a confrontation between two people trying to wrestle with an atom bomb reveal of the truth. And she probably, of course, Edie heard about this probably on TV.
Yes. She's literally been watching panic, the news. She looks completely shocked. She's there. Her hair's all over the place. She's just been glued to the set. She's probably seen Neil's face and some of the people, you know, the faces of his friends and all these other cohorts hearing about this huge robbery that went down, gun violence, etc. And then he just walks in the door.
Mm-hmm. He just walks in the door. And the thing that always drew my attention to this scene was the way that he's always doing something else than talking to her.
Yes.
He doesn't So this is interesting. He didn't go into the room with her, which I would hope most of us would do if we got caught in some kind of trouble and our romantic partner was calling us out. We go, no, he doesn't do that. He goes in the kitchen.
And he just grabs a drink of water.
Yeah, he's like, I just need water. And not only does he want water, he spends all of the time, and she's almost like interrogating him.
Yes.
Right? She asks like 3 or 4 questions, boom, boom, boom. And he's not even looking at her most of the time. He's fiddling with the bottle of water. He's going to the fridge. And it just really emphasizes the disconnect. And I also think Neil's trying to play it a little cool. Right?
He's trying to play it. There's so many moments. I love him as a character, Neil McCauley. He's so beguiling.
Oh, yeah.
Because in this moment, there's been a couple of moments where he's tried to play it cool with Edie and he's kind of keeping her. It's almost in the same way. It's a way subtler version, but it's like what Vincent Hanna does with a crook, Neil is doing in his relationship. Mm-hmm. Like he is literally all over the map. One day it's beautiful origami serviettes on a glass, like the most personal, perfect little touch. Nice, you know, sappy phone calls, romantic conversations on a balcony overlooking, you know, this beautiful illuminated ocean of lights that is LA. And then now, she's like, was that you? Like, she can't believe it. Like, it's not, you know, you said interrogation. And I feel like she's grasping at straws. She doesn't even know. It's not even interrogation. Mm-hmm. She can't even get her words out. She's like, was that you? And he's just, did you do that? And he's like, I tell you what I don't do. I don't sell medals. It's just, there's such a, in so many other movies, and this is what I've found, like deep diving into the dialogue and relationships in this show, and which has been so great with all of the guests, is that line would have been like a clang in a much snappier. I use Edgar Wright, and I don't mean to demean Edgar Wright, but like he's a guy who plays with genre tropes, and in an Edgar Wright movie, this would be a clang. This would be a hard snap close up. You know, Simon Pegg would say that in a really funny way as Nicholas Angel. You know, and that would be just the way that it was. But in this, he's just like, I tell you what, I don't do. I don't sell medals, and he just wanders into her fridge and grabs a cup of water.
Yep. And absolutely. And I'm happy that you mentioned the history with the lights of them looking at LA.
Yes.
Because something that caught my eye when I revisited the movie recently, not actually for this podcast, I watched it recently last winter. She's in front of a window.
Yes.
And, it's framed and blocked specifically so that it almost to me recalls that great scene before.
Yes.
Of course, now they're inside, but the same window that they walk out of is now her background.
Yes.
And it immediately creates almost like the starting point of their romance. And this is a possible ending point of their romance, depending on how we maybe answer some of these questions.
Yes.
And Mann just plays with that motif in a really, really interesting way. And again, it breaks a lot of the conventional ways maybe that these scenes usually would happen.
I think what's great though is we get this beautiful coda of a previous scene at the beginning of this minute, which is with Cassell's, the amazing Wes Studi, and obviously Al Pacino as Vincent Hanna. And Hanna's been on a conference call sort of lining up things that have been happening throughout the last minute. Some great moments with Drucker and Charlene Chihalas, so McKelty Williamson and Ashley Judd. And Vincent comes into Cassell's and he's like, he's around. Like he's around. There's stuff going down here. Like he's around. We've got 7 or 8 hours. Like all that stuff that I thought he might be gone, he's not. And there's a great contrast here of like, you know, you talk about the great motif in a relationship, the great motif of this hunter and hunted and these two animalistic sort of presences that are in these guys are so present in this minute, which is so cool because you get the immediate stark contrast, like Hanna on the scent. He's like a bloodhound. He's like, he's around. I can feel him. He feels charged up. He's loose. His shoulders are moving. His face is enlivened. Like he's ready to go. This is exactly the moment that he lives for, with an 8-hour window to close this guy down. Like this is exactly what he wants. And then you get Neil, and this is the first time that Neil looks like he's lacking composure. He looks tired. He looks all over the place. Mm-hmm. He just walks in. And so when he's out of that control and he's not pristine, and he hasn't, the shields just go back up. Like he's just like, I'm in protection mode. Mm-hmm. He knew the risks. You know, we haven't even gotten to the comment about Michael, which I'm sure we will. But
right.
I love that contrast immediately, because you go, even just in body language, such an amazing body language, the way he's framed, he doesn't look as cool and smooth anymore. It's Vincent who's looking very loose, and we're ready to go there. But here the way the score tinkles with Vincent's excitement that Neil's still around, it tinkles here with it's like the pressure of glass breaking. Like how you said, we're like now in the fish tank. We're not in the beautiful seaside anymore. We're in the fish tank.
Right, absolutely. And interestingly, I think a lot of people would describe Michael Mann's filmography in general as a filmography of connections and disconnections between people, whether that is in the crime world, the undercover world, the colonial era, whatever it is. And in this case, we have another web of connections and disconnections, right? I mean, you mentioned Hannah. Hannah actually comes in from outside. He's also framed with a window behind him.
Yes.
And so we have that LA skyline we remember from a couple seconds before. Whoever had the previous minute really had the skyline. And Edie also has the window. So immediately they're framed within the context of the geography of LA. So we immediately know these people are related. These two people are still related, let alone the cutting between the storyline so directly.
Yes.
And the parallel between the composure and not, etc. So that is all, I think, very, very deliberate to keep hammering home the kind of connection between the relationship between Hannah and Macaulay. And here, it's interesting because while that's emphasizing the connection between them, and they're going one direction, which is to the inevitable conclusion between them.
Yes.
Here, not only is Macaulay trying to maybe reconnect with Edie, but now there's a literal wall between them.
Yes.
Very deliberately. He weaponized a wall. And it's not even a full wall. Like, we have this little window between the kitchen and the front room, and he's using it to create literal distance. I've recently been going through a bunch of Antonioni movies. I don't think it's a coincidence that I've been going through Mann and Antonioni at the same time, because they both use space and geography very similarly. And this is an example of a literal Antonioni metaphor for the drama.
Yes.
They're not literally, it's not like they're disconnected in space as a metaphor. They are literally disconnected in space in the room.
Yes. Antonioni too. I think this is one thing that Mann has a much more grounded approach, which is, I think, why people don't draw that a conclusion as much, which I love your conclusion, is Antonio messes with temporality much more fluidly than Mann, whereas Mann seems like he's on a clock. You know, he's got that, he's got a propulsive sense of rhythm, whereas Antonio only likes to sprawl. Like, he'll have the clash. I love, Red Desert for this thing of like clashes between, humanity and like industrial perversion and poison. And like, he literally has many frames in that movie where it's just like, the earth's being poisoned and these people, what the hell's happening to them as well.
Right.
And he's got,
although Michael Mann's movie, no, for sure. Not to cut you off, but Michael Mann's movies in particularly, he often frame industrial wastelands as well.
Yes.
So, I think that there is a lot there.
There's a lot there. There's a lot there. Spot on. Very strong Antonioni connection there. That's great. I love that.
Yeah.
Weaponizing a wall.
It's just a tool he uses.
Yeah. Weaponizing a wall is my favorite new alliteration from Brendan. That was amazing. But as they're standing there, I keep going back, and this is where I find myself, and I say this a couple of times, but I'm in sort of a rotation. I constantly am in this rotation. And I think that Neil's boxing himself in here. He's framing himself. And I don't know whether Neil's like propping himself up with the certainty that I'm behind this wall and that if I just stand here, and if I act cool, she was going to find out that there was going to be a bank robbery. Hopefully she wasn't going to know that it was me. She was just going to know that we were leaving and we were going to get out of here. And I was going to have that more, exactly as I think you alluded to before, Brendan, that like more romantic thing we've seen in many other bank robbery movies or heist movies where someone runs in and goes, I've got the cash. Like, let's get out of here. Like, we're going to get out of here and fly out of this place. And I want to really hone in now, because she kind of doesn't prompt about Michael. Hear in this moment an outpouring of the subconscious, which is what I'm noticing again on this rewatch, many rewatches of this, but this particular minute when I reviewed it again for our episode, I was just like, he says, my friend Michael died, not my friend Don Breeden, which is even more tragic. Poor disposable Breeden, but Michael died. And then he just starts going off on a tangent. He knew the risks. He didn't have to be there. And it's just so heartbreaking.
It's a defense.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I think it is him imposing an order and a sense of control where there perhaps isn't any. And he's also dissociating.
Oh, big time.
Right?
Yes.
And
it's a self-interrogation case, where he's dissociating one part of his personality, like the culpable person. He's like, mm-hmm. he's owning something, and he's like, no, I'm not culpable. Like, nope.
Right. Exactly. As if he wasn't calling the shots, as if he isn't the paternal figure of this Altman-like surrogate family, right?
Yes.
He's the patriarch, and he's the one who, sure, he gives advice to people saying, oh, no, you know, you're fine, you should stay out, you should come in, whatever. But at the same time, if he really dictates to these people what the route is, and let me put it this way, if I'm on a diet and I can't have candy and somebody says, now I know you shouldn't have it, but here's a Hershey bar if you want it, is that person really keeping my best interest in mind necessarily? And that's basically what Macaulay does. It's a classic fish bait kind of a thing. And I think he doesn't realize his complicity in that. And he does the exact same thing with Edie.
Yes.
Where he gives this almost dreamlike fantasy where they'll be on a beach and it'll be perfect. And it's very romantic. And it's like a carrot on a stick.
Yes.
And he really manipulates her the way he tries manipulating his crew. But I don't think he's even aware of it. I think he's just doing for him what he thinks he needs.
Yes.
So he's imposing this control on all of the spheres of his life that, not to jump ahead, but I think that's why the ending is so powerful, because it's a release.
Yes.
Of a lot of these scenes, you know?
Yeah, he realizes almost his mantra that is like the underlying sort of motivating modus operandi of everything that he's doing. You know, all the self-deceptions, all the manipulation is just to hit back on the mantra that is the final line of the movie, basically. Mm-hmm. I think you're so right. I think this is why Chris Nolan has such an affinity for Neil Macaulay, because one thing in Chris Nolan's entire body of work is an affinity for characters who are self-deceptive. Like, and mm-hmm. he does that in, and, you know, we talked about Mann and Antonioni doing things like bringing the metaphorical into the literal just to ram home a point. Like, you know, Nolan does that too. Like, literally people who lie to themselves, or we watch some people, you know, hide things in their own subconscious for themselves. We watch people dress up like bats. You know, we watch people manipulate their foes with twins, cutting off each other's fingers to make sure that they can replicate, etc. And there's this great, he loves these characters that are just like tormented by self-deception. I think Neil is that guy. I completely agree. That's what keeps us on his side, is that he kind of knows that the equilibrium, like the juice is worth the squeeze. I'll do anything to keep the equilibrium, to keep the happy family, to keep this. If it means I've got to lie to Chris to hide him, you know, from getting hurt from Charlene's affair, I'll do it. If it means I lie to Charlene that I don't know anything about Chris having anything regular on the side, I'll do it. If it means telling Michael no, but if he does it, that's fine, I'll do it. And so, and in this moment, it's just, you know, it's when you bring it into the house, when you bring it into an intimate, closed space, he looks, might I say, he does not look in place in a home, in any home, really, even in his own.
Right.
But in this place, he doesn't look, this is not a, he's not a domestic cat. Like, he doesn't belong in this house. He needs to be caged. He needs that wall between them. And it's as much, I feel like, the way, especially, you know, Amy Brenneman, what a phenomenal physical performance in this minute. Like, literally, like, she's treading around a tiger that's entered her house. Like, she's ready to get the hell out of there at any minute. And I think that he, in that moment, is just that, you know, he's something completely different than anything she's been expecting in any of their interactions so far.
No, I agree. And I think that part of it is, when we enter her home, we face her back. We don't open the scene on him. We open on her.
Yes.
And she's not facing us. No. And so when she does, I think part of it is he's withholding her immediate reaction to this from us for a split second. So that for just a second, we don't know how this is going to play.
Yes.
And then when she turns, that it means that our entire context of this scene is to an extent through her eyes.
Yes.
The cameras from where she is, we don't really get shots from within the kitchen looking at her. It's all looking within at Macaulay.
Yes.
Right. So I think that it is very much part of this idea that he is in the cage And he put himself there and made going back to the whole idea of how he's done time.
Yes.
And this whole classic Michael Mann theme that we see in a lot of his movies, Black Hat, Thief, whatever, this idea of doing time, or you do the time so it doesn't do you, that kind of thing. Maybe something about this defense mechanism, if we're diving deep, is that he just feels more comfortable in a tight space where he can control himself, where the other inmate in the scene, Edie, can't necessarily get in at him too directly.
Yes.
So maybe that is part of it. And I think that his attempt to manipulate her is part of that. And you mentioned that the thing about Michael. I want to draw you back one line, which is he slips in, "We got to go together."
Yes. Yes.
He just slips it in. It's the only thing he says in pretty much our whole minute where he actually says something about them.
Yes. "We got to go together." Yeah, because he deflects. He talks about the out. Like that, he talks about the out. He's like, "Oh, the out's blown. This is I went to hell."
Yeah.
All external forces. We've got to go together.
Mm-hmm. We got to go together. And I think that's the key of the scene, that and the Michael stuff, because it's like if you broke down what he says, there's three things. There's him describing the external, the job, the professional stuff. There's him and her, and then there's him and his friend.
How is Edie? Isn't it great? How is Edie meant to feel? Especially when you stack those two things against each other. We got to go together. And then with Michael, my friend died, you know, he knew the risks. That's the most like beautifully contradictory Neil McCauley thing you could do together, which is like, we got to go together because this is what I want. I need to have that control. But you know the risks, like people die when they're around me. And the movie isn't on the nose enough. And this is where it's such a, you know, an elevated piece of art, is that it's not on the nose enough to like a lesser movie might try and chunk those ideas together. But it's like, it's telling you everything you need to know about the character, because he isn't self-aware enough. The character, that isn't self-aware enough to say those two things together. Like, we've got to go together. There are risks. You got to go. Like, you got to make a decision. It's me. And we're going to be on the run or whatever. And we've seen that in other movies, and whether it works or not, you know, is debatable on the overall quality of the movie, or what are all the other considerations in the actual delivery of the holistic thing. But I think what works so wonderfully in Heat about this is because it's just this whole guy's life is that we've got to go together. We've got to do the thing that I want, but I will walk away from you in 30 seconds flat if I feel the heat around the corner.
Right.
And we're just like, please don't see the heat, because we would like to see him be happy. Like, there's this weird, you got this weird energy and this weird constant thing like, oh God. And I think one thing you touched on before, Brennan, is like with Edie, it is a fantasy. That was the longest time I really struggled with the Neil and Edie relationship, because I couldn't tell whether he was lying to her or lying to himself. But I think where I've landed, and I think what's great about those two lines and what's great about this minute, is it's just both all the time. Like, that's the thing. He's consistently lying to he and whether it's intended or unintended, he's lying to himself that he needs this fantasy, because he knows that.
I mean, I agree. But let me ask you a question then. Is what he does necessarily different from what you or I do in our own lives? And I think that is something Nolan loves from Michael Mann, and that he's played with, which is, at what point is self-deceit but integral to the way we see the world, to the way we see ourselves? And I don't know if you're a fan of The Leftovers, but
I've not seen The Leftovers. Well, I've heard amazing things. I haven't seen it.
For you or your listeners, but I will say that part of The Leftovers is about how we spin these fictions, we narrativize our lives.
Yes.
And that manifests in your personal life, maybe your religion, maybe your political point of view. And there's a meta narrative element to that. And you see that in Nolan's movies. Yeah. We have to tell this lie to Gotham because it needs to be done. And you see Neil's spin.
It's better for them. It's better for them,
right,
Brendan.
Right. And maybe in some cases it is.
Yes.
And in other cases it's not. And the danger there is when people use what's helpful for other people to let themselves get out of jail, so to speak.
Yes.
And I think that's what Neil does. I think that he's gone as far as he has. He's too good to hold himself accountable.
Yes.
And this is the first moment in the movie, really, where somebody really has to hold him accountable. And that's why I love this scene. It's so small. It's like so brief, a little blip in this almost 3-hour long movie. But somebody for the first time is holding him accountable.
Yeah. And it's even as simple as that was you, like disbelief. That was you. Like,
yeah.
You were that guy that like just shot up all these cops and people died. And, you know, you imagine a 24-hour news cycle, which was emerging in the mid to late 90s, right around this time, you know, with the O.J. Simpson trial and the O.J. chase, you know, through Los Angeles. Like, this is literally 24-hour news cycle was born very, very around this time. And you can imagine how much a heist of that magnitude would be spun through not only American media, but world media. And so
the whole world,
and you would see. And so Edie has literally been there since what, 9 o'clock in the morning for conceivably 12 hours, just consuming just a cycle of talking heads and footage and everything and his face overall and police spokesman and we're hunting them down and we're this and the reassurances and all that stuff. And he just walks in and goes and grabs a glass of water. I'll tell you what.
Absolutely.
I don't do, and some medals.
Exactly. I'll tell you what I don't do. And the thing is, I want to draw attention to something you just said. And this is, again, one of those things that maybe doesn't get brought up as much as some of the other things when it comes to Michael Mann. But this is the absences in his movies, the innuendo. He, despite their length, despite their density, their literacy, and his movies are very dense. You need to see all of them a few times to really plug into what he's doing. He still leaves so much to the imagination. Or what he does is he'll invoke the absence of something.
Yes.
And you just mentioned there's this idea of what was Edie doing all day?
Yes.
What was she doing with this news? And we get that with a lot of the other characters. Val Kilmer's character, he leaves the movie. He walks out of the movie. Where does he go? What does he do?
Yes.
What was that day like for him? What was the lead up in the car to see whether or not he can reunite with Ashley Judd? Like, what was that like? We can imagine. And I think he packs those absences into the drama because hopefully we're thinking about them almost subconsciously, right?
Yes.
And this is a great example of that.
And it doesn't even have to, and what I love about your example with Edie is like, what was she doing all day? It doesn't, and with Val, there's that great question mark for the end of the movie, but it also happens, you know, it happens earlier in the movie. My favorite, you know, lucky enough to talk to a Sean Burns, a Boston-based critic, who's a huge Michael Mann aficionado. And I remember talking to him emphatically that one of my favorite scenes in the movie is Justine's speech to Vincent when he picks her up after the cop dinner. And a lot of people have had a lot of, you know, negative things to say about that. Oh, it's contrived, or it's this, or it's that. And my observation, maybe after literally more than 200 times probably watching this movie and right, thinking about those absences that you're drawing out, is how many times have you been, this is a super relatable thing. How many times have you been pissed off with a partner and you've rehearsed a fight in your head? And I think of how many times that woman has had to wash dishes, stay up till 10 o'clock at night where he's not home. And when she's ready to have that fight, that's not the first time she's had that fight. She's had that fight 100 times in that shitty little tiny, you know, postmodern dead tech bullshit ex-husband's house kitchen. And she sat there and she's had to do it and scrape plates and be by herself and mother this child and, you know, take Xanax and smoke pot and like keep herself medicated. But she's had that fight so many times. And so it's just like the absences sometimes inform the things that are in the movie. Exactly like you said, like this reaction, like her looking like a caged, you know, she looks completely frazzled, like she's lost for words. She doesn't know what to say. And yeah, or like slamming at home with Chris and, you know, the weight of, oh God, what happens to Charlene after this? And oh God, what happens to Dominic? What happens to these people? But yeah, I agree. There's very calculated absences of stuff that you like. And particularly, you know, they even shoot some of it. Like they shot a whole Wangro scene, that you see with Lillian and you see with Danny Trejo, which we talked about in a previous minute. That's just, you know, thankfully it's just omitted from the movie and allows characters to convey and sort of have a little bit of exposition to sort of put the pieces together. And it leaves all that brutality to your imagination in a really disturbing way.
Absolutely. And I would even say that Michael Mann's movies, some more than others perhaps, they are a fascinating study between minimalism and maximalism.
Yes.
Where, especially Heat, because so much of this movie is understated and cool, right? Everybody says it's cool, like it's up there with Drive or Le Samurai from Melville.
Yes.
It's just like the all-timer cool cat movies, right?
Yes.
And I'm sure Tarantino was very offended I didn't cite his stuff, but you know what I
mean?
It's
the difference between getting John Voight to dress as Eddie Bunker or casting Eddie Bunker in Reservoir Dogs. Like there's this fine line between casting the guy or trying to make a cool version of him.
Exactly. But I think that in this movie in particular, so much of it has that understated appeal, and yet it is a 3-hour Godfather noir sprawling epic with almost 20 characters. Some are in it a little, some a lot, but it's all of these absences. And very few filmmakers can balance those two so well. And I like that you brought up the domestic side of Hannah with this idea of the fights that just happen off screen. Well, not only that, but think about it this way too. So she's probably had this literal fight with him multiple times in the past.
Yes.
And it's only amplified times 1,000 when you have to imagine she's there all the time and he's never there. And not only that, but when she tries to confront him, what does he do? He pulls a Neil McCauley and he disassociates. It's a shame that the coffee table scene, the diner scene between the two of them, McCauley and Hannah, wasn't talking about how they both disassociate from their women in similar ways.
Yes.
Because they absolutely do.
Yes.
Right. And that's, again, one of the other parallels of the many that I know you've talked about. I've heard you talk about them, but that's just another one of them that very, very interesting.
But they do it. They do make those confessions, but they do it in a dissociative way, which is like, firstly, you've got Hannah going, "Oh no, my life's a disaster zone." So he just plays it off as a joke. Yeah. And then you've got Neil who plays off the, "I tell her I'm a salesman." And then like Hannah does try and make him own it. Like that's pretty vacant, no? And he goes, "It is what it is." Like bang. It's just like, whoa, that's like a gunshot. Like that hits with such resonance and so powerful. And it's just like, that's what's so amazing about unpacking that scene in this movie and the themes of it, is that like some of these cool is the ability to say amazing lines and just let them flow. Like just let them flow, like just not be waiting for, give it no space to breathe for a laugh or anything or a gasp. It's just letting it all fly in the pace that it suits the characters. I think it's so funny like that.
And casting great actors, and I think having a somewhat abstract score that it doesn't dictate to you how to feel.
I completely
agree.
So
it lets you ease in to the more absurd or even tropey moments of the movie. And I think Ebert made a big deal about Heat and how it just had this uncommon novel-like literary feel to it. And I think that's part of it, the ambiguity of how you're supposed to feel at any particular moment. There's this phrase that I sometimes use, which is he kind of opens the door to let you into its heart, but you got to walk the rest of the way in.
Yes.
And because it's not going to bring you in on its own. It's not a Spielberg movie. And I love Spielberg, but Spielberg dictates to you how you're supposed to feel in any particular moment a lot of the time.
Yes.
Michael Mann does not do that. And I think that's part of it. And going to the coffee scene between them, while, yeah, they do confront each other a little bit, I love that they both talk about their relationships as matter-of-factly as the way that Neil starts trying to drink water in our minute here. They both have that macho bullshit thing. It was like, I'm in control, downslope of a third marriage, so what kind
so
of
what?
Thing.
Shoulder shrugging.
It is what it is.
It is what it is.
Right. That's the discipline, right?
I think for anyone who loves this show, as many of the lines that Brendan and I have just said, if you get them into day-to-day speech, I mean, just do it for your own amusement. It's really fun to just throw it out there. A downslope of an anything, you know, if something's breaking, or that, you know, that car's on the downslope of a...
right, exactly.
Just anything, you know, throw them in there. I think that... You know, going back to your top three that I introduced right at the beginning of the podcast, I think Miami Vice is the perfect example of like literally opening the door And some people, it slammed them, like, they then slammed the door shut. You know, I think the theatrical cut of Miami Vice... Yeah, the theatrical cut of Miami Vice is so... So...
good?
Yeah, firstly, good. I was trying to find the word, but it was just so... Like, for me, it was immediately hypnotizing. It was literally like walking into a club. The music is thumping. There are pulsating bodies. Everyone is good looking. It is sexy. It's exciting. You don't know where you are. And if you're the kind of person that likes to go into a club and have no idea where the hell they are and experience, have like a sensory experience just to acclimatize yourself to a mood, then that movie... is got the perfect opening of almost any movie in this genre, right? It just has this like, but if I think some people are like, where the hell am I? Why the hell am I here? Look at Colin Farrell's mustache. I'm distracted. See ya. And they're just like, I almost feel like the door is closed there, but you're so right. You know, so many of Michael Mann's movies are just like literally, you know, even more classically, like look at Last of the Mohicans is the beginning of like a really furious hunt. And even though it's absolutely staged to perfection and glorious, it's, you know, and even The Insider, you're in a bag. Your head is in a Hessian sack driving through like Lebanon or wherever it is to some sheikh's house. It's incredible. Like you're just, if you want to get into a mood, you want to have a sensory experience and you need to be enveloped by something, like Michael Mann is like, you know, an insanely incredible visceral filmmaker for that. Manhunter, walking up the stairs, looking in the POV of a serial killer. And like right now, you know, we're observing someone who's so much more familiar with a cage than that. Let's go back to Pacino and Casals there. It's a great chemistry between those two. God, Wes Studi has just got such an underrated guy, like just a great supporting actor, sans stoic there. You know, I think so many of the guys who work so beautifully with Pacino in this movie, because he's such a fluid character and he's so dynamic, and that's the whole thing, he's this little dynamo. They just need to be these rigid pillars that he can kind of bounce. He's like constantly bouncing off them. They're like a sounding board always for him. So I think Wes Studi's got like the perfect face and the perfect jawline to just be that guy who just like says stuff to Vincent, and Vincent's right there.
Well, what I would say is that, I mean, okay, so you've just cited a whole bunch of the most immersive scenes from Michael Mann's career, and now you're citing this scene and between Hannah and everything, and I think that part of it is okay, so all of his movies, I think, maybe there's one that I'm wrong on, but if I am, tell me. I think it trains you by opening in medias res and in the moment to analyze psychology, mood, theme, character by action.
Yes.
By behavior. It's what you do, right? And both McCauley and Hannah, not just in that scene, but in the whole movie and in all of Michael Mann's movies, it is all about how they act around other people. And that's why in Heat especially, they fill it with these amazing supporting parts.
Yes.
And they get these great actors to do all of those supporting parts.
Yes.
Because their actions only mean as much as they can based on the people around them.
Yes.
Right. So if there's not people to vibe back at something they're doing, then it's just not going to play. And I think that's never more present than in Miami Vice, because that's like he made a whole movie
of just that.
On that idea. And the opening scene, I think, does that. And just to share a very brief anecdote, I had never seen it until a few months ago. And it was on the US Amazon Prime.
Yep.
The theatrical cut, and I was like, should I watch that? I never did. I love Matt, a lot of his movies, but should I? It has a 60-ish% Rotten Tomato. But Matt Zollerseitz and Bilg, who, and I've talked to both of them, and I know they're big Man people, like they've tweeted a lot about it. And Priscilla Page has talked about Miami Vice. And these are all like people I love, and I love their work. And 5 minutes in, I was like, oh my God.
You're like, this is like, for me. This is for me.
Right. I was. And I think part of it is because everything I love about Mann is like, if he says that Miami is like an opiate for the characters, then Miami Vice is like an opiate for certain types of Michael Mann fans.
Yep.
Because this is a confessional. It is a confessional. And in the same way where these side characters in Heat have to bounce off of these towering classic actors. The whole movie, like, you have a lot of bit parts from veterans of The Wire or Justin Theroux, whose character was career was just getting started, and Naomi Harris, who was in Pirates and then her career took off. These are powerful performers, and they have to hold their own in space, because otherwise the whole tenor of the movie just falls apart.
Barry Shabaka Henley, I mean,
yeah,
oh what yeah, a, what a, and a man regular and a, just an absolute powerhouse in particularly Miami Vice. I think it's so funny that you say this. Like, you go into that movie and almost like Colin Farrell going, you know, Tupacati Mojitos in a gin and tonic, right. And he's like, you know, that lime, yep. What's your name, Rita? You get your tan in Miami. Like, that's, I was just like, this movie's right. This is my movie. This is exactly the kind of movie that I like. I don't need to know anything else. I'm getting it. I'm seeing Ricardo. I'm seeing Sonny. I'm like, this is it. It's instantly grabbed by behavior, posture, the mood, the setting. Do you want to be there? Very, very visceral.
It's all behavior and visuals. That's all Miami Vice is. And yet it is hyper literal and it's hyper abstract. And I think that those two elements are the bread and butter of man. But to go back to the opiate thing, it's like both of them are amplified to this ridiculous extreme. And like, I would never show somebody who's never seen Michael Mann Miami Vice first.
No.
But I would start with Heat, and then I would show them maybe even The Insider next, because The Insider is a step up. That I just rewatched it, as you know, and the aesthetics of that movie are also like very amplified. The score is super loud and drama-y, and the visuals are flashing lights at you all the time. It's almost at times like a Tony Scott movie.
Yes.
Where it's a very stark, intense color palette. And then you keep graduating, you know, on that. And I think that eventually, hopefully, people will be able to get to Miami Vice and be like, all right, I can roll with the jargon poetry of what it's doing, the plot that you probably won't understand. And Heat, it has the same ingredients, I think, but just different amounts. I actually don't think they're that different, but Heat has just enough narrative that people can hang on before falling off that narrative cliff, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah. It's you said that earlier, which I think is just the perfect example of, man, it's like minimalism and maximalism at the same time. Mm-hmm. And with Miami Vice, with the ingredients, you know, the doses are off for some people.
Yeah.
Whereas for others, it's like, oh my God, this is crazy intense, and I'm completely in. Like, it's like sherbet, like just a crazy, like a sherbet lolly of like, you're a little kid and you used to have like a spider putting ice cream in Coke. Like, that's like, it's just, for some people, it's like, yes, this is like so over the top, but I'm all in. And others are like, no, I do not need that in my life. So it's that, yeah, it's a good mixture. But it's also, I think, in Miami Vice, the, I don't know if it's like the air. There's something about the environment where the air is thick and it's heightened.
Well, it was literally thick.
And literally
from
thick.
From the hurricane season.
Yeah,
and stuff.
Thick at the time, and it's just the sweat, and there's, I don't know, it's palatable. And in Heat, that desert, a desert night feels really cool. And there's only several, not very many moments in Heat where it, like the blaring sun, and in one of the forthcoming scenes there is, but it's like that blaring sun isn't there. There's this sort of vacuum of like nice, cool, desert, cool, calm. And like when there are those spaces or contemplative spaces, they just have a little bit more, I don't know, they just feel more expansive. And I think it allows people to just process information a little bit better. Whereas in Miami Vice, it's like you're in the middle of a conversation and then Crockett's staring out to the ocean, having a sort of thematic musing about the sublime, you know, which is going to be foreshadowing what else is going to happen in the rest of the narrative. Whereas in this movie, Neil being by himself and having a very similar moment happens when he's alone, and it happens late at night, and it happens in his isolated space where you can't quite see where he is, but you realize that this is his home. And it's sort of a den moment, and it's got character anchored to it and narrative in that moment, in the way that man's flourishes in Miami Vice can sometimes interrupt the narrative, and whereas in Heat it's like so structured.
No, I think that's right. And I think another big difference is that Heat, it often will inject you with a lot of narrative density that's very, very clear. It has a mastery of exposition.
Yes.
And when to deliver it and how to, and so much of it is visual.
Yes.
And it's hard to screw up exposition when it's visual. So full disclosure, this is a total coincidence that I'm doing this podcast. I'm actually screening Heat for like 10 of my friends.
Yes.
In like a week.
This is great news.
Who have never seen it.
This is great news.
I know. I'm very excited. So this just kind of dropped out of the sky. And I think that part of it is, they're going to be like, whoa. Like when you said The Dark Knight was influenced by Heat, you didn't tell me it remade it.
Yes.
Because the way Nolan delivers a lot of his exposition is with these very visual, almost like mini montages.
Yes.
And that is just ripped straight out of Heat. Like it could not be more blatant.
Yes.
So it's very easy for people to follow. And then when he goes into those more introspective moments, the mannisms that are visual, you can go with it.
Yeah.
You can go where he's taking you. And just to say, I think he also will frame those moments in tableau.
Yes.
Where there's these very hyper-composed images, and it makes what it's about very clear. But this is something I don't know if I've seen people really talk about. Often those moments are really brief. Like most of Heat's most famous shots don't last very long. Like the very iconic scene with Macaulay looking out at the ocean out of his home.
45 seconds.
He too has like a dead tech house, right?
Yes.
That's like, it's a super short shot. And a lot of those like shots are super, super brief. So he doesn't really confront you with how tableau they are in the way that an art movie might, but Miami Vice, it does not care.
it
does its thing.
Different modus operandi. Yeah. Look, Brandon, I just want to say, you really need to come off sabbatical because this has been really fun. And for anyone who's listening, would be able to hear just how insightful and on point this conversation's been. I'm just thrilled that you've been a part of the show. So I just want to say, firstly, thank you for being a part of this minute and unpacking this minute. Guys, if you, as I've said at the beginning of the podcast, if you want to follow Brendan, it's at Metaplex Movies on Twitter. He gives great Twitter. So follow him there. Mate, just thank you so much. I can't wait. Please stay in touch about how your friends enjoy your screening. I can't wait. Let's see if I can like call you on Skype afterwards and get a quick like a pulse check from the audience. I would love that. Guys, this has been another episode of One Heat Minute. I'm extremely grateful for the amazing guests that I get on the show, like Brendan Hodges. Again, follow him. Some great stuff and some great bylines. And as you can hear, he likes all the people that we like on this show. Bill Beery, who's been on the show. I'm just going to check whether you've heard his second episode yet. Yes, you've heard his second episode by the time you're hearing Brendan and I talk. And as again, I did tweet it as a teaser, but for minute 147, Matt Zolazites joins to talk about Neil in the tunnel, that moment of the movie as well. So we've got those guys, those great people who are big Man fans and the Man aficionados in on this podcast too. So very grateful for those guys and so many other people. Brendan, thank you so much for being on the show again.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to be here. It was a blast, man.
Thank you. Guys, thank you for listening to One Heat Minute, oneheatminute.com for everything. I'm Blake Howard, at Blake is Batman on Twitter if you want to find me. And if you want to reach out, mail@oneheatminute.com. Reach out to us. We've had some amazing people reach out, including forthcoming guests, so I can't wait to chat to those guys about it. Garth Franklin is our web design master. Thank you, Garth. Paul Davies does our awesome theme. And thank you guys for listening. We'll catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner. And remember, I'll tell you what I don't do. I don't sell medals.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, Our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.